Hello, and welcome to The Iberian Knot, a history of the Spanish Civil War. Thanks for joining me again this week. I apologize for the impromptu weekend off last week for Labor Day, but in solidarity with the Republican side in the war, mostly their socialist, communist, and anarchist elements, it would be quite gauche to work on the holiday set up for a rest from all labor, no? Either way, I'm back this week, and today we'll be pivoting away from the international reaction to the war and focusing once again on what began as a rebellion and has become an all-out civil war in Spain. The two sides fighting in this conflict could not have been more different internally, despite sharing the same country, history, and language in many cases. The right or nationalist side had expected to have a military takeover of the country in a couple of days, and had now created a conflict with no clear end strategy. The left or Republican side, if not entirely taken by surprise by the rebellion, also didn't have a clear upper hand in the conflict, and was going to struggle to hold what it had kept at the outset of the nationalist rebellion. The nationalists immediately instituted martial law, calling up right-wing lawyers and former military officers to administer summary justice as they saw fit. Political parties were all but eliminated in nationalist Spain, with the Falange Party taking on more the character of a social movement, absorbing a great deal of the fervent Catholicism that the party had originally spurned but shared with other right-wing parties such as the monarchists. The SEDA, the most popular right-wing party not 2 years prior, was dissolved and its leader, Gil Robles, declined to re-enter the country now that war had broken out. Conversely, in Republican Spain, there was an explosion of political parties, social community experimentation, and a rise in participation of even more extreme left-wing parties like the various factions of the anarchists and communists. Nominal political leaders in Madrid and Barcelona didn't really exercise power so much as the leaders of the different unions and political parties in those cities. As I alluded to in episode 5, there was a great deal of brutal killings and other atrocities on both sides of the conflict, but on the nationalist side, it was the stated policy of their leaders to use outrageous violence to cow the population into submission. Their reasons for this were varied. These leaders had fought in Morocco, where members of the Spanish military were fewer in number than the people they wanted to oppress, but had superior technology and the ability to destroy the villages when the locals they were fighting fled to places they couldn't reach. The nationalists in many parts of the country were similarly far outnumbered in many regions they were overtaking by poor people, industrial or agricultural workers, and knew that they'd have to not only kill their enemies, but be open and garish about it to keep the masses from rising up together against them, potentially putting their majority in population against the relatively small military. Through all of this open and wanton killing, the conspirators, the officers, and the soldiers carrying out the atrocities created a blood bond that would make them unable to even contemplate surrender or treaty with the enemy going forward. They knew that if they were to lose from this point going forward, they would face the fate that they had submitted many others to. In nationalist Spain, all left-wing newspapers and political offices were shut down. Any former Popular Front deputies, political party executives, trade union members, and sometimes even those who had voted for the Popular Front were imprisoned or often shot. If the person was important enough, they may be afforded a show trial lasting a few minutes, but would nonetheless face the firing squad like any trade union miner or socialist schoolteacher. Armed gangs of phalangists, usually young men in their late teens and 20s, roamed the countryside, oftentimes very inebriated, and would casually pull up to the homes of people suspected of being sympathetic to the left and kill the men and sometimes the rest of their families without consequence. Emilio Mola, at this time still nominally the leader of the uprising, explicitly said, "It is necessary to spread an atmosphere of terror. We have to create the impression of mastery. Anyone who is overtly or secretly a supporter of the Popular Front must be shot." So this isn't some idea that people have formulated after the fact based on the nationalist actions and situation. It was a stated goal to terrorize the population into submission. The Catholic Church, with the exception of their leaders in the Basque Country, supported the nationalist uprising and only officially asked that those sent off to their deaths were offered their last sacraments. This was rarely done regardless. Priests reported being called to orchards or fields in the middle of the night to take the confession of groups of people that would immediately thereafter be shot and buried in mass graves. Some priests and other church leaders did speak out against violence being committed on the nationalist side, but they were the minority, and many of them had to flee the country to avoid becoming victims themselves. The official sanction of the nationalist side by the church made those members of the clergy that unfortunately found themselves in the Republican parts of the country easy targets for those who wished to exercise their rage at the nationalist uprising, which we will see shortly. One of the more notable deaths during this period of time was that of the poet and playwright Federico Garcia Lorca, who was a native of Granada and was visiting there when the uprising took place. The nationalist side, after some struggle, took control of the city and the surrounding area. Lorca wasn't especially active politically, but he was related by marriage to the socialist mayor of Granada and was hence named as an enemy of the new state proclaimed by the nationalists. He took refuge in a house of friends who happened to be members of the Falange party and hence should have been able to protect him. He was, however, found and shot ignominiously, and his final resting place is unknown for certain. Just to sidetrack a little bit, in 1936, before he died, Lorca wrote a play called La Casa de Bernarda Alba, or The House of Bernarda Alba. The play was eerily prescient about the direction Spain was headed in and could be seen as a grand metaphor for the war that was beginning to play out. In the play, the matriarch of a house in Andalusia becomes widowed for a second time and demands that each of her 5 grown daughters move into her home and mourn with her for 8 years, saying it is a family tradition, although no one seems to have ever heard of it. She won't allow them to wear makeup, demands they only wear black, and allows them to leave the house only to attend church. Even Bernarda's own mother thinks she is using the death of her second husband to go too far in what she is demanding from her offspring. However, her daughters have in many cases their own money, youthful beauty, hopes, and dreams, and therefore find ways to subtly defy their mother, each of them individually lusting after a hot man in the village who hates wearing a shirt. The story culminates with one of the daughters perhaps being impregnated by the man, and the mother supposedly killing the young man with a rifle. Her daughter's belief that her lover is dead causes her to hang herself. Upon discovering her body, the mother demands that no one in the home shed a tear over her death and to tell everyone in the village that she died a virgin. I'll leave it to you to interpret how this play metaphorically describes what was going on in Spain at this most extreme and violent time. After the first few weeks, the gross display of mutilated bodies all around nationalist Spain started to bother even Mola and threaten the nationalists' continued support from the church. Henceforth, the killings would continue as before, but at night, and well away from major population centers. The killings outside of Valladolid and Castilla León, for example, were so regular that, in a macabre display, an entrepreneur set up a churro stand for the nightly visiting spectators. This is very disheartening to me, because one of the best things to maybe ever come out of Spain, in my humble opinion, are churros and chocolate, and to have them associated with such vile acts is unpleasant, to say the least. On the Republican side, the killings that took place were not officially sanctioned by the government, especially not the cabinet in Madrid, and was brutal, chaotic, and random. People like the prime minister, president, or other cabinet members were unable to stem the tide of violence that washed over their side of Spain, and many later admitted that they did nothing, as they assumed that those being killed would be doing the same thing if their side of the conflict had won outright. In a mirror image of what took place in nationalist Spain, all right-wing newspapers and political parties were closed down. Houses of the rich who had either left the country or had been imprisoned or killed for their right-wing political leanings were taken over by unions, political parties, or anyone who had the force necessary to hold them. One of the biggest victims of the violence of the left during this time was the church. Churches were burned everywhere and often were torn apart internally when that couldn't be achieved. Only certain large churches with valuable art or architectural value were able to be saved by the local governments on the Republican side. Those churches that weren't burned or vandalized were effectively closed, as anyone who tried to, say, attend a mass on Sunday would basically be committing suicide. But it wasn't just the buildings that were going to suffer as the church was persecuted in Republican Spain. One notable story was that of a parish priest in Torrijos who apparently told the militiamen who had taken him prisoner, "I want to suffer for Christ." So they proceeded to strip him down, flog him, make him drink vinegar, wear a crown of thorns, and told him that if he had said something against his faith, that they'd let him go. He responded saying, "I forgive and bless you." After some discussion, they anticlimactically shot him. He only asked that he could face them as they shot him so that he could bless them as they did it. Two bishops, so people accustomed to a life of luxury, were forced to wash the deck of a prison ship off the Valencian coast before being murdered near Malaga. The bishop of Jaén was murdered alongside his sister in front of a crowd of 2,000. A nun was killed for refusing a marriage offer from a militiaman who had stormed her convent. Rosary beads were forced into the ears of a monk in Lérida until his eardrums burst. Some were burned, others burned alive, still others forced to dig their own graves before being shot directly into them. So many atrocities were committed that I had to leave large parts of my notes out of this because I didn't want to give you nightmares when you just came here looking for a nice history podcast. Needless to say, Hellraiser, Clive Barker-level stuff took place on both sides, but if you were a member of the clergy, male or female, on the Republican side at the beginning of the war, the best thing you could have done would be to ditch any vestments or other religious markers you had and make for the closest nationalist part of the country. There were a few exceptions made for higher-up members of the clergy who had strong relations with members of the people in power on the Republican side, but those cases were rare. On the Republican side, other ways of life changed overnight. People instantly became more casual in their dress because anything like a collar or tie could mark you out as a member of the bourgeoisie or upper class at least, or a supporter of the nationalists at worst, and therefore make you a target for immediate violence. People stopped saying the religiously derived adios and started saying salud. People stopped using the formal usted and began exclusively using the informal tú. If you were or had ever been a member of the Falange or the Seda, your days were effectively numbered unless you could escape to nationalist Spain. A huge array of different groups organized themselves around the country to fill in the judicial bureaucracy where the government was failing to do so. This was an attempt to legitimize and give official sanction to the imprisonment and killing of the enemies of the government. These groups, oftentimes referred to as Chechas, in imitation to similar groups that had formed in the Russian Revolution, were controlled by whatever political party or trade union held power in that town, city, or region. These Chechas sanctioned the killings of many former members of right-wing political parties, but would also convict their social and economic peers who in the past had shown undue deference to those of the upper class, or insufficient reverence for the new political ideology that that particular Checha was operating under. Random killings continued as well. Many of these were just people getting revenge for past grievances, knowing that there would be no consequences. An anarchist killed the owner of a cafe outside of Alicante with a hatchet because he overcharged for stamps and forced buyers to pay for a glass of wine while they waited. A convict let out of prison during the commotion that was going on broke into the home of the judge who had condemned him and killed him in front of his family. The members of government knew things of this nature were going on, but were unable to stop it. The president of the Republic, Azaña, lived in a palace facing the Casa de Campo, a place you can still visit in Madrid that is very placid and verdant, where firing squads were carrying out mass executions nightly. He became more morose and pessimistic with each passing day, disillusioned that his plan to modernize Spain had fallen into such chaos, anarchy, and slaughter. On July 30, 1936, the anarchist leader Federico Montseny wrote, "We have confirmed something we only knew in theory, namely that revolution, in which uncontrolled and uncontrollable forces operate imperiously, is blind and destructive, grandiose and cruel. How much is wrecked in the heat of the struggle and in the blind fury of the storm? Men are, as we have always known them, neither better nor worse. From the hearts of rogues there spring a latent honesty. From the depths of honest men there emerges a brutish appetite. A thirst for extermination, a desire for blood." And this really well sums up what had happened on both sides of the conflict. At this point, there could never be any treaty because things had been done that couldn't be undone or easily forgotten. Wounds had been created that would take generations to heal. One side had to win, and when they did, they would unleash even more horror to take vengeance for the horrors inflicted previously. Extreme voices on both sides were on the radio, blaring into the night air, saying that when the Nationalists, the Republicans, or the Republican side won, that the losers would be erased from history. And each side was able to listen to each other's propaganda, which just instilled more fear and willingness to go off and fight and die to win the war for your side. Emilio Mola established the leadership of the Nationalists in the Castile-León town of Burgos on July 24, 1936. At this time, the future power dynamics were being fixed by the communication Franco's emissaries were establishing with Germany and Italy, but inside Spain, each major conspirator at that time controlled their own chunk of Nationalist Spain. Quiepo de Llano, he of the nightly aggressive and antagonizing radio broadcasts, controlled Seville and increasingly large parts of Andalusia. Franco kept control in Morocco and the Canary Islands, but was moving his men to combine with de Llano's forces in Seville. Mola had his headquarters in Burgos, the stronghold of the Carlists in Navarre, and the rest of the northern provinces under his control. They effectively didn't have a government at this juncture, so they used the established structure of military law to administer the parts of the country they controlled. Many civil servants in Nationalist Spain continued to report to work as usual, and business continued as before, with the exception being that many labor and economic reforms instituted by the Republican government were ignored. Mola was actually not even in contact with Franco for much of the time early in the war when he was transporting his troops across the Strait of Gibraltar, which made him even more ominous and potentially powerful in the eyes of the Nationalist supporters. He was like the hot, rich guy in high school that doesn't talk much, so everyone in school can project all of their own personal wants and desires onto their idea of him. So monarchists thought Franco would come with his terrifying but powerful African troops to reinstall Alfonso XIII, while members of the Falange thought perhaps he'd use his power to instill a military dictatorship with strong Catholic values, but with himself as a dictator. But mostly everyone just hoped that he would win the war for them in as little time as possible. The Nationalist side already had the financial support and help with obtaining additional credit from Juan March. The international banking community was effectively betting that they would be the winners in the conflict. In addition, they appealed to the populace to donate whatever they could to the cause in order to take out Red Spain, as they referred to the Republican side. They received huge amounts of precious gems, hard currency, and goods from the upper and middle classes. It could be said that the middle class was split during this conflict, as many saw their interests best fulfilled by the Nationalist desire for stability and a return to a more rigid form of government, while others were driven by their political ideals that made them want to be able to participate in a democracy or see a communist or anarchist revolution take place. The Falange grew rapidly at this time as young people in the right wing were heavily influenced by their propaganda showing them as crusaders against the invading foreign Reds. This was in contrast to the actual leadership of the Falange, which was divided and in many cases imprisoned in a Republican part of the country. Their founder, José Antonio Primo de Rivera, had been locked up in Alicante since shortly before the war began. At the same time, portraits of Quiepo de Llano began to appear around Seville and those of Franco and other parts of Nationalist Spain in an attempt to build up cults of personality like Hitler and Mussolini had successfully done in their own countries in the previous decades. They began to include in their rhetoric much more references to the church and the idea that this was a crusade against those who had attempted to destroy the best parts of Spain, namely their traditions and faith. From a visitor's perspective, Nationalist Spain would have looked like the Crusades were going on, but in the age of mass media. One would see crosses, relics, and other symbols of the Reconquista plastered all over public squares, billboards, and the sides of buildings. Anyone who was not of the political opinions held by those in power were daunted enough to either keep quiet or try to escape to Republican Spain through some point in the border between the two sides. While the right was slowly uniting in Nationalist Spain with their capital in Burgos, the left in Republican Spain was divided geographically and politically. There were various revolutions taking place in different parts of the country under varied political ideologies and with vastly different levels of changes applied to daily life, politics, and commerce in each area. In Madrid, the UGT, or Socialist Union, de facto controlled life in the city, but their membership was becoming more and more communist-leaning on a daily basis due to the effective propaganda of the Comintern. Their messages follow two central themes. One was that the current conflict was historical repetition of Napoleon's 1808 invasion of Spain, and that all parties needed to come together to maintain democratic governance. They were moderating their previous message of the core communist idea of the government and economy being entirely controlled by the party in order to attract more adherents. They proposed that any future political changes could be worked out after this conflict was won for the Republican side. The Comintern was not the only socialist voice in this environment, by any means. Many others still wanted to use this opportunity to create a Spain even more radical than the one that had so recently failed to satisfy anyone. The reality on the ground was that while every industry that was related to war material was taken over by the government, at the end of the day, the supposedly red-slash-socialist-slash-communist government took over control of only around a third of all private enterprises. Most business people maintained control of their interests, but other changes would affect them adversely. There was a large change in currency as the unions began to issue their own vouchers, which the businesses would then have to seek payment on with said unions. This caused their value to decline and caused many businesses to be able to make any profit. In addition, a 50% decrease in all rents was declared, a major demand of the working and lower classes of all political stripes. There were public food kitchens, but bread was scarce as large parts of the wheat-growing areas in Castile-León were in nationalist hands. Many in Madrid were unhappy with or afraid of the changes they saw going on all around them and wanted to flee the country without alerting either the government authorities or their neighbors for fear of reprisal. For this reason, the embassies of various countries filled to bursting, housing potential political refugees until they could somehow be removed from the country. A well-off engineer even created a fake Paraguayan embassy that took up three buildings and housed around 300 people. In Barcelona, the situation was quite different, as things often are in Barcelona compared to Madrid. Barcelona had been an anarchist stronghold for years, so when the nationalist rebellion took place and Spain was torn into various pieces, Barcelona was effectively under total anarchist control. There were records of over 350,000 anarchists in the city at the time. They controlled every factory, public utility, and government office. This also meant the repression of the church was near total. Every church but one was burned, and it was saved by the Generalitat for artistic reasons. The anarchists, who had all of the power, still had the stigma against government as an idea, so members of the Esquerra Party, or the Party of Catalonian Independence, continued in nominal power. Luis Companys declared himself president of Catalonia instead of president of the Generalitat. He and the anarchist leaders were on their way to restoring order in Catalonia, sending troops to try and retake parts of Aragon under nationalist control, and take control away from the central government in regards to their borders and other responsibilities theoretically under Madrid's control, without communicating any of this to Madrid. Later, Azaña would write that Companys and other Catalonian leaders had used the excuse of the nationalist uprising as a pretext for Catalonian independence, and he wasn't wrong. When the Republican side should have been uniting to take on nationalist forces, they were instead infighting in a million different ways. And this was true even in Barcelona itself. The anarchists were in control of industry and public services, but the UGT or socialists were in control of the banks. Those in government were primarily interested in Catalonian independence and not one or another political ideology. The socialists were divided between the newly formed United Socialist Party, called the PSUC, United Socialist Party of Catalonia, and the anti-Stalinist Trotsky-inspired POUM, or Workers' Party of Marxist Unification. Their main beef was that the PSUC, in agreement with the Esquerra, or Catalonia Nationalist Party, wanted to continue to allow certain decisions to be made by the central government in Madrid, and for their supporters to follow mandates from the international communist hierarchy, more centralized control, more or less, while the POUM required less rigid devotion to international communism as represented by Stalin's Russia, but more structure than what the anarchists were offering. The relations between these disparate but sometimes overlapping groups would deteriorate over the course of the war and disable what should have been a war engine for the Republican side due to what, in retrospect, seems like petty infighting. In the beginning, the nationalists had mostly had success in the cities of Andalusia, but not in the vast countryside. In these areas, different systems of collectivization took over. In some areas, people who owned their own small parcels of land were allowed to continue as usual, while other large holdings were either divided up along the lines of the agrarian reforms designed earlier in the Republic or made to be collectively owned and run. This could mean that the original owners were expelled and ownership was divided by the owners, or that the original owner would stay but allow workers onto the boards where decisions were made and oftentimes share profits. Food and drink were often provided by the local government to the population, and the amounts would vary wildly from place to place. In at least one extreme case in a village near Córdoba, the regime set up by the lower classes once they gained control stopped all commerce, closed the bar, and even abolished the Spanish staple of coffee. There were forms of collectivization of one level or another taking place all over the country's agrarian heartland. Those Republicans in the North were in the most miserable position as they were surrounded by nationalists on all sides. Those in Asturias had enemy holdouts within their territory, as well as being themselves under siege by nationalist forces. They had, however, always been a stronghold of the political left and were not going to go down without a substantial fight. Their food resources were low due to being cut off from the rest of Republican Spain, then they were forced to subsist on fish, beer, cheese, and cigarettes. They, like their counterparts in Barcelona, acted mostly independently from Madrid, more due to their inability to communicate with them than due to any ambitions for future independence. The Basque Country was the only Catholic stronghold of the Republic, and their church leadership was being begged by the rest of Catholic Spain to side with the nationalists. Those leaders knew, however, that if they were to change sides suddenly, that they would only set off an internecine conflict in their own territory. The social and economic changes in this region were far less than those that were experienced by the rest of Spain. There was a 50% cut in rents imposed by the government, which I guess was just a thing that you got if you were on the Republican side of the war, and a decree that no one person could be a director of more than one company, which would have hit very few rich people and no middle or lower class citizens, and a new board of assistance for people in need was created. But apart from that, the radical steps being taken in other parts of the Spain were not, and most people for the moment were able to continue their lives as they had before. In the summer months of 1936, Franco had his Foreign Legion forces transported to Andalusia, where he was assisting Quijano in the takeover of that province for the nationalist side. The Republicans were terrified that it was only a matter of time until Franco directed his forces toward Madrid. In what was probably a bit of relief for them, as it allowed them to start fighting their enemy directly, and because it wasn't Franco and his legion that was attacking, Mola sent nationalist forces to attack two points in the mountain north of Madrid. One column under General García Escámez to the Somosierra Pass to the northeast of Madrid, and another to the Pass of Alta de Leones to the northwest of the city. The nationalist columns were met by civilian volunteers and regular soldiers from the Republican side that belonged to all left-wing political parties. Despite hard resistance from the Republicans, and interestingly, both of Calvo Sotelo's assassins died in this battle, both passes were won by the nationalists by July 25th, but their forces lacked ammunition. For this reason, they could not continue towards the city, but held open the two main gateways from the north to Madrid for their backup forces to plow through in the future, as needed. Afterwards, Mola sent three columns from Pamplona, a right-wing Carlist stronghold since the beginning of the uprising, towards the Basque province, and another 1,200 men from that city to Saragossa to reinforce the nationalist forces in control there. Around the same time, at the beginning of August, various political parties, trade unions, and regular soldiers loyal to the Republic, Catalonia or the Generalidad, had amassed some 20,000 troops under various commanders that were ready to march towards the line dividing nationalist and Republican-held parts of Aragon. This was an unofficial and constantly shifting border that went from the border of France near the town of Jaca, south through Huesca, with Huesca on the nationalist side, continuing south with curves through Teruel, also under nationalist control. I'll put a map on SpanishCivilWarPodcast.com to give you a better idea of what I'm describing. The largest single force under Republican control was that under the command of Buenaventura Durruti. Durruti was radical, even for an anarchist. He had, in a previous life, been a railway worker in Lyon, but had throughout his life become known for violent attacks against people in power on the right. He had participated in the murder of the Archbishop of Saragossa in 1923, made an attempt on Alfonso XIII's life in 1924, and had previously assaulted a bank in Gijón. Now, at the head of 6,000 troops in western Catalonia, on the precipice of invading nationalist-held Saragossa, he declared his radical intentions clearly. He told a Russian journalist at the time, "Perhaps only 100 of us will survive, but with that 100, we shall beat fascism and proclaim libertarian communism. We shall subordinate ourselves neither at Madrid nor Barcelona, neither to Azaña nor companies. If they wish, they can live peace with us. If not, we shall go to Madrid. We shall show you how to make a revolution." You can understand that it wasn't incredibly helpful to the Republican efforts that A, they were carrying out this offensive without communicating with Madrid or other Republican forces, B, the largest groups of troops were made up of people with political ideologies that made them want to vote on every order they received, and C, the leadership of the forces was declaring publicly that if he won, he'd set up a state independent from both Madrid and Barcelona. The anarchist forces were poised to invade nationalist-controlled Aragon, and nationalist forces were in control of two major mountain passes that led directly into Madrid. At the same time, neither force felt strong enough to proceed, the Republican due to disorganization, and the nationalist due to lack of ammunition and fuel. This is the part of the war when the communists start to really gain more following on the Republican side due to their ability to recruit internationally for the military, as well as gain funding and military support from Russia and show the most military discipline of all the left-wing forces. They created a famous 5th Regiment, which was able to provide for itself independent of the government and theoretically, though not always in practice, instituted political commissars so that military decisions would have a political review before taking place. In a time of extreme disorganization, a centralized decision-making body must have appealed to many on the left who feared authoritarianism but wanted desperately to win the war. One communist who has been in the background this whole time, and I haven't made mention of so far, I don't believe, was Dolores Ibárruri, who was often referred to as La Pasionaria, or in English, the Passion Flower. Born in the Basque Country in 1895, in 1916 she married a socialist miner who would introduce her to Marx's writings and make her rethink her traditional Spanish Catholic upbringing. She was heartily impressed by the Bolshevik uprising in Russia in 1917 and would write her first article under the moniker La Pasionaria in 1918. She would participate with her husband in the communist breakoff from the Spanish Socialist Party in 1920. From then on, she would become a powerful orator and hold various positions of power in the Spanish Communist Party. One of her sons would eventually die in the Battle of Stalingrad on the Russian side. She was imprisoned many times by various governments due to her political activities, protests, strikes, and speaking out against the government in ways that were prohibited at the time. It could be said that she was a Spanish communist before it was cool. She had famously smuggled hundreds of children out of Asturias in 1934 during the miners' strike that had eventually been put down violently by Franco and his cronies. She had represented Spain in international communist meetings for decades. Fernando García Lorca was one of her friends, and the last time she had seen him, he had promised to write her a poem. He died before being able to compose it. She served in the Cortes of the Second Republic, where she would give fiery and sometimes threatening speeches against her political opponents. She famously said to Cabo Sotelo, shortly before his death, after he complained that the government was failing to prevent the death of members of right-wing political parties, quote, "You have spoken for the last time." There doesn't seem to be any evidence that she was involved in his death that sparked the war, but the timing was bad. After the breakout of the war, she became an international symbol for those who were against the nationalists in the war, even if they themselves didn't subscribe to communism or her particular Russian and Stalin-focused view of it. Much like Queipo de Llano was doing nightly in Andalusia, La Pasionaria would give speeches on the radio that called for people to join the fight against fascism, donate to the cause, and travel to Spain to fight on the nationalist side. One of her most famous phrases, "No pasarán," or "They shall not pass," would become a battle cry for everyone fighting on the Republican side. Hence, one of the many columns leaving Madrid to fight in the mountain passes to the north would carry her name, and her image was plastered over all kinds of propaganda created by the Comintern. One of the other communists that would rise to prominence in the Republican military and be a great propaganda tool for them was Enrique Lister. Like Franco, he was originally from Galicia, but had spent a lot of his childhood in Cuba when it was under a dictatorship. As an adult, he would join a miners' strike in Asturias that resulted in him spending time in prison. After being released, he spent 3 years in Moscow taking courses on how to effectuate a communist revolution in his home country, both politically and militarily. He would go on to be one of Republican Spain's most successful military leaders. Along with Lister was another communist leader that went by the name of El Campesino, or the Peasant, whose real name was Valentín González, which some said was blatant communist propaganda to peel off the actual peasants who at that time mostly belonged to socialist or anarchist parties or unions, while he himself said it was a nickname he'd had since he was a child. He had a large beard, was loquacious, and was considered very physically strong. His specialty was guerrilla fighting, but his success in that area would lead him to promotions that he was ill-fit to handle. he and Lister would be heading out of Madrid to fight, while La Pasionaria would stay near the center of government to influence it, and to continue to rally the troops and general populace with speeches and radio broadcasts. While the first major fighting was taking place north of Madrid and on the western border of the province of Aragon, another major point of contention was just south of Madrid in the Alcázar in Toledo. If you refer to the map from episode 5 and know that Toledo is about 44 miles or 72 kilometers south of Madrid, you'll see that it was consequently entirely within Republican-held Spain. As I also mentioned in that episode, at the breakout of the Nationalist Rebellion, Colonel José Moscardó, who was in charge of the military academy housed within the Alcázar, had sided with the uprising but was opposed by the majority of the surrounding community. Consequently, he fled with around 1,300 people, around 100 of whom were hostages belonging to left-wing political parties, into the Alcázar fortress. Members of the military and civilian government in Madrid were trying to get Moscardó to surrender, but as I detailed at the beginning of this episode, he had no reason to believe that he wouldn't just be lynched the minute he and his followers stepped beyond the walls. There was a story that he was called and told that his son, who was in Republican hands, would be shot if he didn't give up, and that he said something to the effect of, "If that's true, I commend your soul to God. Viva España. Goodbye, my son." But later research has pretty definitively shown that this was nationalist propaganda, as the phone lines had almost immediately been cut at the beginning of the siege, and no call could have taken place. There was nonetheless widespread belief that such a conversation took place, making Moscardó a hero and potential martyr for the nationalist side. Those inside were able to raid a nearby granary for wheat supplies to make bread, and as the siege continued, they proceeded to butcher and eat the approximately 177 horses that were inside the fortress as well. In a bit of black comedy, various supporters of the Republican side, as a day outing, would drive up to within shooting distance of the Alcázar, squeeze off a few shots into open windows or at people patrolling its perimeter, have a nice lunch, then drive home. Despite the empathetic symbol that the nationalist side successfully made out of Moscardó and the other defenders, if you could call them that, of the Alcázar, no one ever saw the left-wing hostages that went in with them ever again. The siege of the Alcázar would be an inflection point in the war that would extend it substantially. In Franco's mind, he was planning on finishing up the nationalist takeover of Andalusia, extend the territory on the border with Portugal under their control, sweep across the northern strip of Spain, still under Republican control, and then focus on Madrid, Castile-La Mancha, Barcelona, and the Mediterranean coast. But the desperate situation of those in Toledo, and their transformation into a symbol for everything good in Republican Spain, i.e. the military, valor in the face of overwhelming odds, and perseverance through extreme hardship, just like Jesus Christ, would make it so that Franco's plan would have to be superseded by the need to free the fortress. This was going to be a real pain for him, because there was no quick and easy way for him to get his forces to Toledo without fighting on all sides all along the way. But even more than the need to save lives of those on his side in the war was Franco's need to continue to be seen as the all-powerful military savior of the country, and not relinquish that title to another military commander that was able to come down and save the Alcázar from the north before he could reach it from the south. So that's where we'll leave it for this week. There's a stalemate in the mountains north of Madrid as the Republicans herd the cats that metaphorically make up their forces, and the Nationalists wait for more supplies and reinforcements. Franco is seeing his plans diverted for symbolic reasons more than anything else. Both sides in the war have committed so many atrocities that the only way this will end will be when one side wins absolutely and completely. The victors will be as bloodthirsty as ever, as both sides are using the truth about what happened after the outbreak of the Nationalist Rebellion to stir up their masses, making them willing to head out and die in battles and skirmishes all around the country. The Nationalists are in the process of figuring out what exactly the form of government they wish to take will be, while the Republicans are, in many cases, planning their own small utopias in different parts of Spain based on very different and often conflicting left-wing political ideologies. Next week, we'll talk about the huge arrivals of international troops that came to Spain to assist the Republicans, and how the intervention of Franco, with the support of Germany and Italy, will begin to give the Nationalists the upper hand militarily, if not in international opinion. Si me quieres escribir, pasa.
esa primera línea de fuego. En el frente de Candesa, primera línea de fuego. Si te quieres poner bien.